Salam, and welcome to the Logic of the Birds podcast. With me today to discuss the poetry of Fariduddin Attar are Professor Cyrus Zargar of the University of Central Florida, Professor Nicholas Boylston of Seattle University. Professor Zargar, why don't you start us off? Can you please tell us a little bit about your relationship to Attar and Attar's poetry? How did you first get introduced to Attar's poetry, and what attracted you to it?
I would say that, especially as a graduate student, there were three poets who had a certain quality to them that the only way I would describe it is the poems seemed as if they were written yesterday, even though they were written 800 years ago. And actually, one of them was Hafez, and Hafez has a phrase to describe it. He calls it Sher Attar, fresh poetry. And the three poets that really struck me, one was Hafez, the other Iraqi. I mean, Iraqi's ghazals especially, they're so alive, you know? But then Attar. And throughout his poetry, it just had this quality as if he were writing them for me at the moment, as if they spoke to me, and without any of the sort of contrived language, you know, direct. You often don't need a dictionary to read Attar. Usually don't need a dictionary to read Attar. I mean, most often he's just using the simplest he's using very simple language to communicate incredibly complex ideas. And that's what I was looking for the whole time. And my appreciation for that, the more I read him, increased. So every poem of his I read, everything I read, it was like some discovery in the realm of ideas. And by the way, I'll just end on this. The other thing about Attar is that he translates well. And that's not true for every great poet. It's not true for Hafez. He translates well because of that simplicity, because he's dealing with images and simple language and narrative, like Maulana Rumi. So all of that, especially someone as, you know, the bulk of what I do is translation, you know, it appealed to me as a student and as, you know, as a scholar of Sufi poetry.
Mm, that's great. Yeah, I found that to be true for me too. I first came to Attar in translation as well. And then I learned a little bit of Persian, and obviously there's some stuff lost in the translation, but not as much as with a figure like Hafez. Wonderful. Professor Boylston, what about you? How were you introduced to Attar, and what's kind of drew you to his poetry?
Salam, it's great to be here. So for me, like a lot of people, The Conference of the Birds was the first thing I read. So I remember it was the Penguin edition, aptly published. And then it's Davis and Darbandi, such a beautiful verse translation. And I remember in Egypt on the bus going to Mount Sinai, it was half a lifetime ago, reading this, and it was a revelatory experience. Just The Conference of the Birds, especially in that translation, changes people's lives. It opens you up to a whole new world. And that motivated me to go and learn Persian. And I worked on Attar a bunch when I was writing my dissertation. And again, I agree with everything Dr. Zargar said. And he's also a poet where you just keep discovering more. It first seems clear what he's telling you about. In fact, he'll slap you over in the face and beat you over the head with certain ideas. And you think, okay, that's it. And then you find out there's something far more profound going on. So he really rewards going deep. And he's just so, so rich.
Mm, wonderful. Thank you both. Okay, Professor Zargar, let's go back to you. I wanted to ask if you could provide us with a brief introduction to Attar's context, his life. You know, where was he born? Where was he from? Where did he die? Did he travel? And how does this tell us something more about his literature, his poetry?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. So Attar's life, other than some very basic facts, is somewhat shrouded in mystery. I mean, we know some things about him, but we don't have as much about him as we do, let's say, someone like Maulana Rumi, because the biographies that were written about him were written much later and are, you know, intertwined with legend. There's nothing wrong with that. But it means that the first thing to do is to focus on the outline. And the outline is that he's from Nishapur, and he's from Nishapur at one of its, well, in fact, I would say its worst moment in history. We think of the Mongol invasions that mark the end of his life, and that's one of the facts we know, is that he was killed during the Mongol invasions, for the most part. We see that as sort of the big moment, but there were crises that were happening within his lifetime that shaped his poetry as well. So the Oghuz Turks, they would raid Nishapur and take over the area in 1153. And then around 5 years later, the city was ravaged again by the factionalism between Hanafis and Shafis in the city. And this would have affected Attar directly because he was a Bazari. His father's Dokan, his father's, you know, merchant shop was almost definitely burned down in the process of that, of those factional rivalries. All these things would have affected him. He seems to have had a small circle of devoted listeners and fans who would read his poetry and enjoy it. And he would give lectures about, you know, the spiritual path and the things that he writes about in his poetry. But then when you start to look at the legend, there's some beautiful things that come out. And I actually think that the legend matters, you know, when it comes to the life of Attar. Every good Sufi saint has a conversion narrative. And his, it's a play on his name, Attar. So he supposedly had a beautiful Attari. He had a beautiful, let's call it herbal pharmacy, with where they would also sell, you know, elixirs and fragrances. And there was this sort of band of renegade libertine Qalandar types that were passing by. By the way, this is what will still happen if uncouth people try to go into someone's shop. He was trying to get rid of them, especially at the front of them was this madman that they comment was from the Farzana order. So he's trying to get the madman to go away. And he says, the madman responds by saying, you know, look, I can leave this place in an instant. The question is, what about you? Can you leave all these beautiful things that you have in an instant? And Attar's, you know, a little bit fed up with him, says, well, how would you do that exactly? At which point he takes his cloak off. He puts it down like as a pillow beneath his head and he just dies. Attar is so moved by this that he decides to undertake the path more seriously, divorce himself from the dunya, from worldly attachments, and he becomes the Attar that we know today. And the second and last thing I'll say is, of course, a famous story about his death. So we know that he died during the Mongol invasions. And supposedly he was a very old man. Legend has it 114 years old, probably not quite that old, but one Mongol soldier decided to take him as a slave, to enslave him, and wanted to sell him to someone. He goes to the first person, and someone offers the Mongol soldier 1,000 dirhams. And Attar says, no, you can do better. I'm worth something different than that, you know. Hold on. So they go to the next person, and the person offers him just a bag of chaff, like basically a bag of garbage. And Attar says, yes, that is what I'm worth. At which point the soldier becomes so enraged that he beheads him. And supposedly that's Attar's death. There's a shrine to Attar that's currently standing in what might have been where he was buried. We say he's from Nishapur. I won't get into the details of what that means because the city had to actually be kind of rebuilt at a certain point. But yeah, those are the basic outlines of his life. And his biggest legacy, of course, as we'll discuss, are his works, which are, I mean, he was very prolific.
No, thank you for that. So Nishapur at the time, this is in Khorasan today, kind of what we call close to Central Asia, Iran. And Nishapur at the time, it was a big city, right? Was it one of the first cities in the world to reach 1 million people? Is that correct?
If you count all the surrounding satellite villages, yes. Though at the time of Attar's life, it had probably, that dwindled pretty significantly because of some of the social issues that I had mentioned. But at its peak, and if you count the satellite villages, because he's from a satellite village, and Muhammad Reza Shafi Kadkani says he's from Kadkan, and that's probable. So not exactly from Nishapur, but the area.
All right. So it's from this big kind of Central Asian city. It's on a Silk Road route. It's an important part on the Silk Road route. So it's kind of cosmopolitan. And then by the time he comes around, it's riven by all of these factions and raids coming. And then the Mongols are on the horizon.
And that really puts an end to everything for some time until it's rebuilt.
Wow. All right. Professor Borelson, anything you can add to us this about Attar's context? Did he stay in Nishapur and Khorasan? Did he travel? Do we know anything more about his life that can help us understand his poetry, his literature, his context? What did he do for a living? Did he work as a kind of pharmacist?
Yeah, that's the challenge with Attar, is we know very little more than what Dr. Zargar has already told you, actually. And yeah, he did seem to work as an Attar. His name, pharmacist, is what he did. And we know a little bit from his life. but a lot of legends grew up around Attar, and even a lot of works that don't seem to have been written by him at all grew up around this figure. So it took a lot of time for the field to kind of discern through and figure out which works Attar had actually written. For example, when the story Dr. Zargar told, he's killed by this soldier, his head is severed. There's a book attributed to that severed head called The Headless Poem. But the thing is, the style is very different from Attar. So either with a severed head, your poetic style changes a lot, or it's written like 100 years later when people were writing quite extreme Sufi ideas. Everything is God, you know. Well, Attar says that, but in a much more extreme and intense way. So a lot of these works are not written by Attar. So even just to figure out what Attar actually wrote, which we think we have a good idea about that now, took a lot of time. And the ideas about his life, really, it's down to this limited amount that Dr. Zargar already told you.
All right. Well, thank you very much. Now, let's turn to his poetry. Both mentioned he wrote a lot of poetry. He was very prolific. Professor Zargar, could you give us examples of some poems or some verses of Attar's that are among your favorites or that are perhaps the most celebrative, and tell us why? What makes them so great? Why are they so popular and celebrated?
Well, I'll just do one so that I can, and then I'll leave the discussion open for others. So I'll tell you my personal favorite, and I hate to pick something that's so popular as my personal favorite, but I can't get over it. I really can't get over this poem because I believe it to be a kind of key canonical story, key canonical narrative within the canonical Mentakoter, Speech of the Birds. The story of the Sheikh Hasan An is really, to me, one of those amazingly important tales. So the story of the Sheikh Hasan An is narrated by Attar at a pivotal point in the story of the Speech of the Birds. It's a point where these birds have to commit. They have to have an aim. They have to have a reason to undertake the journey because they're very reluctant. They have fears. They have misgivings about themselves. They have attachments to the world. And their leader, the Hudhud, has to convince them, no, you know, this is worth it. So the story he tells here, it's really the climax of the Mentakoter in some ways, right? I mean, other than the huge ending, the reveal, it's this really important point. And it's told in as if it were a historical account, as a hagiographical account of a sheikh who had spent much time at the Kaaba and had developed this devoted following. But he was plagued by these dreams. He would have these dreams that he's worshiping an idol in the center of kufr in that time, center of kufr, of infidelity, of disbelief at that time in the Muslim world, when, by the way, the Fourth Crusades are ongoing, you know. And this took me a while to understand why Byzantium, which is the center of disbelief that I refer to, why it would be thought of as such a hostile environment. I had thought that it was the nearest sort of point of the, you know, Christian power, and maybe that was why. But what I came to realize is that that's where the Crusaders at that time were centered. They had come and taken over that area. So he has a dream that he's worshiping an idol there, and he decides he has to set out and see what it's about. So he and his followers go there, and as the story goes, he immediately sees a Christian girl on a terrace, like on a balcony, and falls so deeply in love that there's no remedy for his love other than for him to just stay there. Now, the part I'm going to read here is just a few lines. It's from the scene, let's say, when his murids are trying to convince him to come back, to leave off his love for the Christian girl. It looks like he's even giving up Islam for her at this stage. And he will. Eventually he'll renounce Islam because she wants him to. She wants him to renounce Islam, drink wine, burn the Quran, worship an idol. He does all of those things. Then, you know, tend to her pigs. He does all of those things. But this part, to me, really encapsulates what I would call Halajian kufr, Halajian disbelief, the love as a form of kufr. Of disbelief, being hated to gain love. So the lines I'll read are, On degar yek goft e pire kahun, gar khatai raf bar to tobe kun, goft kardam tobe az namus hal, tayebam az sheikhi o hal o mahal. On digar yek goft e danay raz, خیز خود رو جمع کن اندر نماز گفت کو محراب روی آن نگار تا نباشد جز نمازم هیچ کار. آن دگر یک گفت تا کیز این سخن خیز در خلوت خدا را سجده کن. گفت اگر بت روی من اینجاستی سجده پیش روی او زیباستی. آن دیگر گفتش پشیمانیت نیست یک نفس درد مسلمانیت نیست؟ گفت کس نبود پشیمان بیش از این تا چرا عاشق نبودم پیش از این. So I'll read the translation. Another disciple said, O elderly master, O sheikh, if there's been moral error, repent as soon as possible. He, the sheikh, said, I've repented of a claim and concern with spiritual states. I'm reformed from being a master, from awaiting ecstasy and other hopeless things. Another said, O keeper of divine secrets, arise and collect yourself in the prescribed prayer. They're trying to do anything they can to bring him back. He said, Where is the mihrab? Where is the prayer niche of the face of that painted image to leave me occupied in nothing but prayer? Another said, For how long will you speak like this? Arise, and in khalvat, in devotional retreat, fall prostrate. He said, If my idol were here before me, prostration before her face would be something beautiful indeed. Another said, Don't you have any sense of regret? Don't you miss even for a moment your having been Muslim? He said, No one has ever been as regretful as I that I had not earlier than now been a passionate lover, an ashiq. When I teach this with my students, it's very dramatized, by the way. If you give people roles, you get how beautifully dramatized it is for a narrative poem. Now, of course, we know the ending. In the end, he does do the toba. His students go, they perform this long 40, someone advises them, they perform a 40-day period of worship. The Prophet Muhammad intervenes. He converts back to Islam. So does his beloved, and then she dies. But the point of the story, of course, which we can talk about later, is that you can't really reach that highest level of knowing God until you've gone through something like this, a fall in love. Falling in love, literally falling, like falling from your horse, falling in love is a necessity.
Mm, beautiful. Yeah, I taught this story this semester, actually, in class, and one of the students remarked this, you know that song, I would do anything for love, but I won't do that. He kept saying that, and then he kept actually doing that and doing that and doing that until there was nothing he wouldn't do for love. Yeah, very wonderfully recited. Thank you. Thank you very much. So this story occurs in the context of the long poem, The Conference of the Birds, you know, which is the story about these birds that set out to find the Simorgh, and it's one of Attar's Masnavis. Professor Borelson, can you tell us a little bit about Attar's other works? He wrote other Masnavis. What other genres did he write in? You said he wrote a lot. What did he write?
Certainly. So he has four Masnavis that we think are attributed to him, and three of them have these frame tales, like Conference of the Birds, this journey to find the Simorgh. There's a beautiful one called The Book of Affliction, Musibat Name, which is about the wayfarer of contemplation who goes through every level of the cosmos trying to reach God, and all of the beings of the cosmos, from Gabriel down to the mountains to the dust, tell him, we're burning in love for God, and here's the teaching for us, but we're stuck at this level, and you're a human being. You're the only being in the cosmos that can transcend. And so he learns from every level of the cosmos, and then he starts meeting the Prophet, starting with Adam and going through to the Prophet Muhammad. And then the Prophet Muhammad initiates him into his own inner reality, and he travels through the levels of his own selfhood until he reaches the ocean of the spirit, which is the meeting with the divine. So another really beautiful tale, which sadly isn't available in English yet. Then he has the Ilahi Name, the divine book, the book of God, which is about, the frame tale for that is this king who has six sons, and each of the sons has this desire for something worldly. One wants to marry the fairy princess, the most beautiful woman in the world. One wants to learn alchemy so he can be rich. One wants the seal of Solomon, Solomon's ring, to have power over the world. And the king basically teaches them why each of these desires for something worldly is misplaced, but then each of them in fact represents a spiritual reality. So if you seek beauty in the fairy princess, you have to realize that true beauty is found within, in the soul at peace, once you transform your own soul. If you seek alchemy to turn stuff into gold, you just get a bunch of gold and like, what do you do with it? But if you seek spiritual alchemy, then you realize that the body is the location of contemplating the divine. So that's another really powerful one. Again, Atta has such rich teachings, as we're already seeing. And then he has one called the Asrar Nameh, the Book of Mysteries, which doesn't have a frame narrative, and it's more mysterious what the underlying structure is there. And I've got some ideas about that. So those are the four Masnavis. He also has a collection of quatrains, the Book of Chosen Poems, Mukhtar Nameh. He also has the Memorial of God's Friends, Tezkirat al-Awliya, which is this prose work where he gives biographies of the friends of God, and is one of the classics of Persian prose, memorializing and remembering and bringing to mind all of this Sufi tradition that he's inheriting, so it can be contemplated, and that contemplation transforms you by thinking of the messages of past masters. And then he has the Divan, which is a collection of ghazals and qasidas. So I've actually got a couple of poems here from that, and one of them kind of responds to or builds on the themes that Dr. Zargar raised, so I could read a little of that if you like. So he says, "The light of faith is from the whiteness of his face. The darkness of infidelity is from the end of a strand of his hair. Every atom in the two worlds, whatever there is but a veil over the sun of his face. Whoever in the two worlds takes a direction of prayer, even if he is unaware, he faces his direction. All of that commotion on the day of resurrection is arrayed on the battlefield of his magical glance. The resurrection, yes indeed, is but the flash of vision from the arrow shot from his gazelle-like eyes. Even the earth itself is but dust on his way. Every celestial sphere is head-spinning in his alley. The fragrance from his threshold reached down to the heavens, and until the resurrection it is flipped upside down from that smell. Until Atta received a whiff from his threshold, the heart does not realize that it is by his side." That's one of the ghazals' selected translation. And with the ghazals, I read them as being an expression of a certain spiritual state. So they could actually be an expression of what Sheikh San'an is going through in the middle of that story. Different levels on the path, you know, the experience for Atta is changing. The relationship with the divine, with earthly beloveds, is changing as we walk through life. So the ghazal, each poem kind of summarizes one heart, one state, one spiritual state of awareness. And of course, you don't know who the beloved is. So I translated it as his in this one and her in the other poem I can read. But there's no gender in the Persian language, so you can read it anyway. You could read it as God. This particular one, there's reasons to, from the tradition, to read it as the Prophet Muhammad, actually. But you can internalize this if you want. So again, here the idea is that part of the idea is whatever there is somehow is a manifestation of the divine reality, and everybody is facing that divine reality, even if they don't know. Because everybody takes a qibla, which is a direction of prayer. Everybody has some kind of intention in life. Everyone is seeking something. And for mystics like Atta, we're always seeking an infinite reality. We're just either seeking it where it is infinite, or we're seeking it in reflections, in delimited realities, whether that's seeking pleasure, whether that's seeking fame or wealth or things like that, in the same way in that divine book, the king was teaching his sons about that. And then this line at the end is so beautiful, that till Atta receives a whiff from his threshold, the heart does not realize that it's by his side. For Atta, that one way of summarizing his entire teaching in every book is that the way to meet God is within. So the heart is already in the presence of the divine. You just have to remember what the heart is. You have to search for the lost heart.
Yes, wonderful. So it's kind of a lot of the themes of Conference of the Birds come up. That's the work of Atta, as I know best. So all of the different birds have their own particular reason for not going on this, you know, difficult quest to see the Simurgh. The duck likes its pond and staying clean. The nightingale has its rose, and the hoopoe, the hoodhood, the guide, kind of flips it on them, much like the king. And it says, well, you like the rose because of its beauty, but its beauty compared to that of the Seamorg is what you really love is just a reflection of that. But then also one of the interesting things I notice in Comforts of the Birds is the whole journey is like 2 pages. If that, you know, it's like about 20, 30 verses. And then all of a sudden they're there. And then when they're there, the Seamorg is revealed to be the Seamorg, 30 birds. The phoenix, the griffin, is revealed to just be, because, you know, in Persian, the Seamorg, the same thing. They are what they were seeking. So yeah, it's wonderful, this ghazal, you have both of these things. Everybody is seeking this one reality, and that one reality is closer than you could even imagine. No, thank you. That's a great ghazal. Do you have any more for us? Another ghazal you'd like to read?
I thought I'd read another one. It builds on some of the similar themes with sun and resurrection and these kind of thing. So this one says, "Agar ze pish jamalat niqab barkhizat ze zarre zarre hazar aftab barkhizat." So it also uses the radif, this form that every line is going to end with the word barkhizat, which means to be removed or to rise. Usually to rise, but also to be removed. "If from before your beauty the veil will rise, from every single atom a thousand suns will rise. The world from the awakened commotion will rise in resurrection when her half-drowsy eyes from sleep will rise. In a gathering in which her wine-coloured lips do laugh, if the intellect sits down there, utterly wasted it will rise. If her lips should come out laughing from every direction, a thousand roaring drunkards without wine will rise. When the emerald of the line of your lip boils forth from that ruby, a thousand ferments from that ruby grape juice will rise. From such a fragrance of the sweat of the rose of her cheek, from the thorn of envy, a commotion from the rose water will rise. Such is it when she breathes that like the blowing of the trumpet, a resurrection in the world entirely drunk will rise. The impurity that befalls you when you make a claim to her love, when you make ablutions with blood pure, it will rise. For such filth which remains so long as you don't weep blood, think not that with an ocean full of water it will rise. Who is there who's aware that to fry every liver, from her musk-scattering locks what heat will rise? Who is it has a sign of when she wants to plunder the two worlds, when from the sun of her face the veil will rise? If Farid were to sing poetry using his own words, from before the fountain of life the cover will rise."
Wow, bah. Lovely. Beautifully translated as well, too. I know Hafez has another ghazal with the same radif, I think, right, with the will rise. But this Attar's ghazal seem to be, each verse seems to be more connected to the others than, you know, is this a difference in, I know I've heard about, there's a Khorasani-style ghazal and a Iraqi-style ghazal. Is that what's kind of going on here? Attar's writing in this kind of Khorasani-style ghazal where the verses have more kind of connections to each other?
Yeah, I find that to be somewhat helpful. Once you get to Hafez, this image of stringing pearls, like poetic composition, like stringing pearls, really comes through, where every line is just a completely different world and a completely different perspective. And then trying to fit them together as part of the puzzle, where for someone like Attar especially, often for Maulana Rumi as well, I do see it to be this Khorasani style. At first, it's stylistically a bit more simple and straightforward, but also the connection is just really clear. So he'll repeat the same word and he'll just make a slight variation. Whereas Hafez would, if he repeats something, he's going to do something completely different with it. So there is quite a difference of aesthetic experience. Attar's style is often he takes up one theme and then he really drives it home for you. He wants you to fully digest every idea that he treats off. So this one, the idea is there right at the beginning. "If from before your beauty the veil will rise, from every single atom a thousand suns will rise." Attar never pulls any punches. He's very extreme in the way he expresses things. And so he starts with something extremely extreme and just keeps at it. There's the punch and then he just keeps going.
And that's just a small note of a similarity between Attar and Hafez in their ghazals, is that both of them will often appear as characters in it. I mean, and that's not always the case in Persian ghazals, that the persona of the poet is such an important part of it. And you just saw it in what Dr. Boysen just, you know, translated for us. I mean, it's beautiful. It really, it hits you hard when he places himself in this lover's dilemma, you know. And Hafez, of course, perfects that.
No. Yeah, that strikes. Reading this ghazal, but then the other things of Attar I've read, mainly in translation, it feels like I tried boxing for one summer. It feels a little bit like reading Attar feels like, you know, your first couple times in the ring when you're just getting hammered in the getting hit in the face or getting liver shots, kidney shots one after.
It can be a lot.
One after.
It can be a lot.
Yeah. It hurts so good, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, I prefer sitting in a comfortable couch and reading Attar to getting my liver pounded to a pulp. But he has very, very punchy, direct, and as you said, he keeps hitting the same point again and again. If the poetry weren't so nice with all these beautiful images, it'd feel like he's berating you, like he's kind of spiritually berating you into, like, why don't you get it. So Attar, stylistically, I mean, is he highly regarded for his style of poetry? Is he beloved for his style of what are the things? I mean, we mentioned this kind of punchy, very direct, very kind of alive sense of his poetry. What do people like about Attar's poetry? What did they like about his poetry then?
Well, I mean, with Attar, the thing you can't avoid is the discussion of influence. I mean, you have Sana'i, and then you have Attar, and then you have Mawlana, and and Mawlana Rumi himself recognizes that on multiple occasions, that you don't have Rumi without Attar. So the first thing is when people talk about Attar, is how significant his contribution is. He takes the spiritual Masnavi to just a whole other level. And this will sound sort of odd to people, but he does things with it that even Rumi doesn't do. I mean, if you look at just the framing narratives and how nicely the themes of the maqam, of the different, you know, maqamat, the procession to the real fits in so in such a lovely way with the framing narrative. There's an architecture to his spiritual narratives that I don't think anyone has other than him. I mean, I venture to say I don't even know in any other poetic tradition who has something like this. So that's really, to me, how he's remembered, as this kind of mainstay, as this, he's in a way, he's an innovator, and he leaves this legacy for those who come after him as a poetic storyteller, first and foremost, but then also in all the other ways with the ghazals, especially with the ghazals that emphasize, you know, Qalandar themes and Kufr themes and things like that start to become really popular.
And so what if, I meant to ask you this when you were talking about Sheikh Saman, what, for our listeners who might not be as familiar with this notion of Halaji and Kufr, what is going on with the celebration of Kufr, of infidelity in Attar? So we know there's a longer tradition of this from Halaj and Ainul Qudat Hamadani and other figures, but if you could just explain this. Because, you know, to the, let's say, average contemporary Muslim, they're like, what is he going on about? Why is he celebrating Kufr in this way?
Well, the way I would explain it is, this would especially ring true to anyone who's been part of a religious community. If someone's ever been part of a religious community, what they know is that the stereotypically religious person, okay, is judgmental, concerned with the approbation of others, how they are seen, their reputation. This is the stereotype. I'm not saying this is true of all or even most religious people. The way they are perceived by others matters a lot. Yes, they're devoted, but their devotion focuses on acts, right? Sometimes outward acts that others can see, right? And anybody who's been part of a religious community, Islam or otherwise, knows this. So what happens to the sheikh? Well, the sheikh becomes completely uninterested in his reputation. He becomes completely uninterested in what others think of him and in devotional acts. And it becomes replaced by a love that he's willing to sacrifice everything, even his own reputation for, which was a huge reputation, by the way. It becomes replaced by this all-consuming love that doesn't let him sleep, that makes him, basically he sleeps in the alley like the dogs that are outside of her door just to get close to her. The message being that all of us should love God, the way that the sheikh loves that Christian girl, so that you're willing to give up even your reputation, what others think about you. You know, you don't fear, as the Quran says, the blame of any blamer. That's halaj encapsulated. And there's a very old tradition of that in Khorasan with the Malamati spiritual order that existed even before Sufism was there. So I think that's really the theme of kufr. It's often misunderstood. It's kufr as a virtue, which is hard to understand because it's a metaphorical infidelity. There's another dimension to it too, which I need to point out. I mean, it's important. On a deeper level, it's about the contradictory nature of witnessing God in a manner where things are Him and are not Him. And the fine line between God being everywhere and nowhere, God being the beloved and not being the beloved, that fine line, when you walk it and you cross it, you cross over into something that if the average Muslim were to know it, they would say you're a disbeliever.
Oh, excellent. Professor Boylston, anything you want to add to our discussion of infidelity?
Yeah, this is a huge one. So it's worth recalling that the Arabic root kafara, from which kufr, infidelity, comes from, means to cover up. So there's a type of thinking going on this poetry, following Sacha Gomorata, I refer to it as correlative thought, where you can use the term kafara or kufr for anything that covers anything up. So on the highest level, if you enter a state of mystical annihilation in God and you're no longer aware of the world or the ego, they'll use the term kufr for that, because everything other than God has been covered up. So that's a way in which the meaning becomes exactly shifted. And then there's a kind of intermediary meaning, which is, I find, at the heart of all this Kharabati poetry, you know, going to these areas on the outskirts of town, which is a mixture of the brothel, casino, and tavern, is that getting to a point where you can see limitations, where you can see the veil, that which covers up the divine, as also manifesting the divine. And that can't be understood by reason. Everyone, all of these poets are going to say reason can never get to that point. But if you get to a point of witnessing that which removes us from God, that which delimitates us from God, that which covers us from God, is in fact actually revealing God, then you understand the unity of God behind all things. You understand why there's evil and suffering in the world. You understand wheresoever you turn, there is the face of God. And you also understand the negative impulses within yourself, and they become integrated within the heart. So it's a very lofty kind of spiritual process of transformation. And in a sense, the last one on the individual level, when negative aspects of ourself become integrated, because you realize that actually all of the impulses within us as human beings have a proper place. And if they shift to their proper place and are integrated within the heart, they're actually good. Because human nature, the fitrah in the Islamic perspective, is fundamentally good. And just in our fallen state, we've forgotten and things are kind of out of place. So meditating on these ideas is also a way of taking you to those, your own boundaries within yourself, and making you come face to face with things in yourself that you've been denying, and the kind of shadow dimension of yourself that then needs to see brought into the light through this beautiful poetry and contemplation of the divine that's happening there.
Oh, that's great. I remember when we were reading Conference of the Birds in our class, we had students identify with, you know, which bird they're most identified with. We had a couple students who were like, no, I'm all the birds. I see all the birds in me. We're like, yeah, that's actually the point. Each bird represents a kind of aspect or tendency of the soul. And it sounds like the same thing is true in Ilahi Nameh with the different king's sons and all of these other characters. And then even in the ghazals as well too, with these different impulses going in different directions.
It's all about you beginning to end. It's all about you, different levels of who you are.
Right. And the whole journey takes place within you in Musibat Nameh. So we've already covered a lot of ground in some of the major themes and motifs in Attar's works. But Professor Zarghar, are there any major themes or kind of central concepts in his work? You said he hits you with some of the most complex and profound spiritual meanings in very simple language. Are there any other kind of common themes that you find repeated in his work?
Well, we've hit on a lot of the main ones. Storytelling itself obviously is valued, and it's an important part of everything he does. And also, if you Sufism, you know, the tradition. If you start to look at Sufism, you look at some of the major, even like technical terms, tafrid, tajrid, tawheed. You know, you start to, you know, what is ma'rifa? What is ma'rifat? What is the reality of tawbah? You start to see his poetry is actually highly influenced by a man who's well-read in the Persian Sufi tradition. So really, I mean, if you were to pick out the major themes from Qushayri, or pick out the major themes from some risala, some Sufi risala, and get like, okay, this is the... Those would also be the major themes in his poetry. And by the way, that is something that is often missed in discussions of Attar. If you start to treat Attar like a secular poet, I think you're missing 75% mm-hmm. of Attar.
Mm-hmm. No, again, yeah, going back to Conference of the Birds, those different valleys track really well onto the Maqamat schema as well. And his Tathkirat al-Awliya, his hagiography work, maps really well onto other works that you'll see, and each of the different figures there embodies different kinds of virtues or stations on the spiritual path. And no, that's fantastic. Now I want to ask about, so Attar is a great poet. Almost everything he wrote was poetry. I wanted to ask, why did he write in poetry? Is it just simply because poetry was popular at the time? You know, he was a kind of public preacher, kind of, you know, he gave these public lessons, and poetry was nice for that. Why did Attar choose to write poetry, and what does he have to say about poetry itself?
I think he wrote poetry because he was very good at it. Because other than that, his view on poetry seems to be one where poetry is the finest expression of an existential pain. And in fact, he says in the conclusion of the Mantiqatayr, of the Speech of the Birds, Conference of the Birds, he says, look at this. He says, don't expect poetry from this book. As sara dardi nagah kun daftaram, taze sad yek dard dari bavaram. He says, read my book with pain if you want to understand even 1% of my anguish. Right? So he's saying there, I have this pain of being separated from God. And if you've had it, then you know what the value of my poetry. And he's not shy about the value of his poetry. He says it's an ocean of reality. It's that he's giving you, there's an ocean of reality, and he's giving you pearls from that ocean. He's very clear that his poetry is great. So I think he knew his own talents. But yeah, I think that's the main thing, is that it's that poetry, more directly than anything else, communicates the angst and the anxieties and the pains of one's existential separation and longing to return to the One.
Beautiful. Yeah, I know. It's a shame. I don't think that epilogue is in the Dick Davis Penguin Edition translation.
I think it's in the new edition.
It's in the new edition? Okay, great. Because it's wonderful. And I know there he said he's very proud of the fact that he was never a court poet. He said, I didn't waste any time praising this guy or that guy. I just write my spiritual poetry. And it's awesome. And I remember that epilogue is interesting because in some places he seems to put himself down and put poetry down. And then other places, like you said, you know, these are the most valuable pearls of speech from the ocean of gnosis and things like that. I'm glad to hear it's in the new edition. That's great. Professor Boylston, can you give us some more insight onto what's going on with Attar and poetry? What does he say about poetry? Why did he write in poetry? I mean, he was clearly good at it, but... Why did he choose that to communicate his spiritual pain, his longing, these pearls of wisdom?
Yeah, first on the pain thing, it is important to realize that pain takes such a depth for Attar. And in a sense, his genius is living in a context where a lot of people are experiencing a lot of pain and suffering because of the kind of disorder that Dr. Zagar told about earlier. Pain becomes the spiritual path for him. So in the same way that for Rumi it's thirst that is the core of everything, for Attar, actually pain becomes beautiful. And in the beginning of the Memorial of God's Friends, he says, contemplate the stories of these past friends of God in order to become a point of pain. In order to become a point of pain, which means that pain actually integrates you into and unifies the soul, because it burns away everything other. All ego is burned away. So actually pain in Attar becomes the spiritual path, which is very powerful for people experiencing a lot of physical, mental, emotional pain, that can be transformed into something that leads to unity. There's a nice passage in the Book of Affliction, which is all about pain. It's worth mentioning Navid Kermani's beautiful book, Atar Job and the Metaphysical Revolt, on this topic. So in the introduction, Atar says, he said, "O pain, you are my cure. You are the soul of my soul, my infidelity and faith. Should you lay 100 mountains upon my neck, all of that without me you lay upon yourself. What a wondrous pain you are. I know you not. I only know this much. My soul belongs to you. Should I weep, you tell me, how long will you weep? And should I laugh, you say, laugh not, but weep. And if I do, you say, do not hear these words. And if I don't want to do, you're going to say, do it. Should I eat, you say, fast, O ignorant one. Should I not want to eat, you surely will tell me, eat. With you, what can be eaten? Nothing can be eaten. With you, what can be done? Nothing can be done." So just turning the complexities of the human state, the fact that the ego is always stymied by the world, into a non-dual awareness is really beautiful. So pain is definitely at the heart of it. And then one other piece of this puzzle comes, I think, at the beginning of this same work, the Book of Affliction. So for Atar, contemplation is really important in poetry. And Dr. Zargar made a great point. Even within the frame tale of Conference of the Birds, the actual journey of the birds is very briefly discussed. It takes less than 2 pages. What the frame tale is a discussion between the birds. So it's actually the story of the birds is mostly language, and it's birds telling poetry to each other. And that's because there's something that mirrors what Atar wants to be happening with the reader as they're reading these poems. There's something about contemplating this poetry that has a transformative effect in the soul. Because imagination, if we imagine things, it actually changes us. So he's using poetry to activate the imagination and take us through a process of transformation that it may be preparatory for spiritual transformation, or may well actually involve that spiritual transformation itself. So in the Book of Affliction, the main character is called the Wayfarer of Contemplation. The Wayfarer of Contemplation. Salika Fikrat. So he says, "For the wayfarer, that which traverses the way is his contemplation, Fikr. A contemplation that is derived from his invocation, Zik. Invocation must be uttered until it brings forth contemplation, bringing forth 100,000 virgin meanings. The contemplation of reason belongs to the infidels. The contemplation of the heart belongs to the man of the work. The wayfarer of contemplation who has embarked on the work has become manifest through the heart, not through reason. The folk of the heart have the taste of another understanding, which is higher than the understanding of both of the worlds. Whosoever is cast into the work by that understanding casts himself into the sea of mysteries." So here the work here is the spiritual project. And he's saying, look, most scholars, their project is just on the level of the mind. It's just on the level of reason, and they're going to study all these books and come up with commentaries and things like that. But the heart as a faculty of awareness actually brings forth a completely different approach to life, which is rooted in spiritual transformation. And so it's poetry that speaks the language of the heart, because the language of the heart is imagination. But to get access to the heart, you also need spiritual practice. So he says you have to do invocation, you have to do dhikr, you have to do the remembrance of God, which, as the prophet said, is the polish of the hearts. So poetry for Atar is also a type of language that can't be separated and removed from spiritual transformation, whereas the mind easily can be. So I would say poetry for Atar is the language of the heart, and that's a main reason why he writes in poetry.
No, wonderful. Thank you. I just wanted to come back to this question about poetry and pain. You know, for personal experience, I know there's a close connection between poetry and pain, and I'm sure they've done, you know, studies now about how people in pain in hospitals writing poetry can help them deal with that or something. But I wanted to ask both of you about what's this relationship between poetry and pain? Besides, we know breakup albums tend to be artists' best, you know, Adele has a breakup and then releases a banger album or something like that. But or Beyonce, or who have you. But I wanted to ask you to flesh out a bit more this relationship between poetry and pain in Atar, because pain is such a main theme, and I think also one of his most enduring legacies in the Persian poetic tradition. But why are poetry and pain, why do they seem to go together so tightly for Attar?
So I would say, in a sense, to write poetry, you have to be in a kind of flow state. It has to flow through you. And what stops a flow state is the presence of the ego and self-awareness. It's like when you're on fire in basketball and you're just hitting every shot. As soon as you turn around and say, oh, I'm on fire, I'm in the flow state, then you lose it. So this kind of poetry that people like Rumi and Attar are writing, it's coming from a place where something of that self-awareness has been washed away in whatever level. And so pain does that. Pain destroys the ego. Pain is defined as that which the ego doesn't like. And when it's a pain you can't avoid, there's a kind of process of breaking the ego that happens. And Attar writes about this throughout the Book of Affliction. And he goes all the way. He completely faces that pain that seems to have no purpose whatsoever. So I like the image of the bug in the rug. There's a bug crawling through this rug, and what he sees is his problems, the strands on the rug. And then he steps back from the rug and he's able to see this big pattern, and those were just like the dark strands. So life has dark strands in it. But Attar doesn't stop there. Attar like takes a cigarette and burns holes in the rug. Attar goes all the way of saying true pain really is terrible. There's no, oh, this helped you grow and things like that. He has passages where he's like, that. No, this is horrible. This is can't be justified in any perspective. And it's just a hole in the fabric of existence. It's pure nothingness. And then still you zoom out and you realize that cigarette burn in the carpet was also part of the beauty of the pattern. So on its own level, it can't be understood, and it completely breaks you and leaves you with nothing. And then somehow the journey continues for Attar. And that turns out to be part of this journey that ends with immersion in the ocean of the spirit. So ultimately, when you reach that immersion, the ocean of the spirit, it's pure plenitude and it's pure joy and it's pure bliss. But on the journey, that terrible stuff that happened is terrible, and you can't justify it from its own perspective. So he has such a profound understanding of pain that doesn't come across as like, oh, you're going to grow from this, and those kind of things people tell you when you're in pain, it really doesn't help. And his poetry comes from that, where it's really at times it's like it's just flowing forth from Attar as a point of pain, and there's no ego in that, in his most powerful passages, I would say.
I would only add just one small thing to that really profound explanation. It's sort of a boring perspective, but I think it's important to be said, which is that, you know, artists, they're pushed into forms that suit their social historical circumstances. And Attar's time and place, that language of pain, metaphor, imagination belonged in poetry. So you today in 2023 could have a prose writer. You have poetic prose. You have prose writers who could do a lot of this. You have visual artists who could express much of this. But neither of those things were really done in Attar's context. So it's true that in some ways the form of the art does shape the art, but in another way, you find what's appropriate for your message. You find the medium that fits the message. And it just, at that time, the poetry was a place where you could say something like, you know, we were talking about infidelity. You could speak about spiritual infidelity, and it was okay in poetry, right?
No, that's very true. I think somebody called the Persian-Arabic Urdu poetic tradition the most sadomasochistic artistic tradition ever created by people. No, it's because it's where people talk about pain. I mean, in this tradition, even in the few autobiographies that people have, they usually it's just kind of list, and then this happened, and then this happened. If you want to get how they feel, how this particularly how they felt, how they experience pain, it's always expressed in poetry, or almost always expressed in the poetry. So poetry, as you said, for these kind of you could say psycho-spiritual reasons as well as socio-historical reasons, poetry seems to be a good way to express and talk about pain.
And I'd say part of that is the meter. It gives order to these experiences and inextricably brings beauty to these experiences. So this is something you find in classical Persian music as well, which is coming out of the same tradition, is that for people who aren't familiar with it, it often sounds sad, but if bitterness becomes sweet, then what does sweetness become? So there's something about if you bring that pain into the art form, into the beauty of the form, whether it be music, whether it be the meter and the language and the metaphors of poetry, that experience which first appears as just terrible somehow becomes beautiful at the same time. So it's extremely poignant at that point and transforms the hardest parts of human experience.
Oh, that definitely rings true to my own experience writing poetry out of difficult. It's like that Japanese art with kintsugi, where they take a broken vessel and they fix it back together with the gold. And I think a lot of poetry can be like that. Something breaks you. You try to put yourself back together in language in a beautiful way that kind of gives order and makes it somehow more bearable. And in a way that's not, oh, God has a plan. I think it's right. Those things, right. Or oh,
that's reason speaking.
Yeah, or oh, he or she's in a better place, or something like that. That seldom really touches your heart or makes any. It's kind of that doesn't really help much. Okay, no, thank you so much, both of you, for these wonderful reflections. I want to turn now to Attar's legacy. So we said, Rumi spoke about him. We said we can see his legacy a bit in the poetry of Hafez, but can you tell us a bit about his legacy kind of throughout the tradition and his contemporary legacy? I mean, who reads Attar today besides students in our classes that we make read Conference of the Birds? And just could you say a little bit about his contemporary legacy? Professor Zaga.
Well, I'll real quickly. One thing we haven't mentioned, and I think it's because it doesn't fit within the boundaries of poetry, is the Tezkiratul Awliya, the memorial of saints that Dr. Boylston had discussed. I mean, it influences our view of Sufi saints in some of them in major ways. I mean, Rabia, the Rabia that we know and that we teach about and that people revere, is Attar's Rabia. The Halaj that is really, Halaj is so much Attar's privileged saint that some thought that there was an Awaisi connection, that he was a Halajian initiated into Halaj's way. But the Halaj we know is Attar's Halaj. That's an important part of his legacy. But just quickly, his poetry really has permeated Persian culture. I'll give you one contemporary example from film, which is Attar's lines and images will appear in the films of Majid Majidi, the Iranian filmmaker. And I discovered this, I was surprised to see that even the title of Renge Khoda, the color of God, comes from these lines from the Musibatname: you bring God's coloring from within, drawn up from the vat of oneness, you've let it in, God's coloring to yourself, given pigment to the leper and visions light to the blind. And the way you know that that's what Majid Majidi is working from is the last part, the giving light to the blind, because it's the story of a young boy who can't see, but using that Sibghatullah image, the coloring of God image from the Quran. So again, over and over again in popular culture, you're going to see Attar's poetry. It's really pervading a lot of the themes, cinematic themes, themes in television. I could give you examples if we were kind of running out of time, but if we had more time, I'd give you examples even from TV. So yeah, I think in that way, his poetry is far more pervasive even than we would realize if we just looked at poetry and the recitation of poetry.
Mm, very good. And the Three Butterflies poem, the famous Three Butterflies poem that I've seen, it's all over YouTube, it's on Instagram and other things. That's Attar, right? The three butterflies who are legend in the story of love. The one sees the flame, the other one gets close to it, and then the third one burns up in it. And I think
it's from the Manticlater, right?
Yes, yeah. I believe so. Professor Boylston, can you tell us, is it true that Rumi said that Attar roamed the seven cities of love and we're stuck in the first alleyway? And if so, is this, can you tell us, flesh out a bit more of Attar's legacy for us?
That's one of those lines that it's one of those things that everyone Rumi says that Rumi said, and then you look through his works and you can't quite find it. But it's so beautiful that it's one of those oral traditions, which is really fantastic. The way I see Attar, in addition to all of these things, is also, because he's so intense, when people wanted to call on some really intense experience or perspective, especially relating to pain, either Attar will be invoked or they'll write something and attribute it to Attar. So you've got all these works, as I mentioned, the Headless Book, the Halaj Book, which is a kind of Halajian approach, and others, this slew of works attributed to Attar, which is from later, but also probably from the Mongol period, also from really intense times where there was both a lot of social upheaval and a lot of immanentist approaches to the divine in that period where people are really kind of going far, far beyond the limits of kind of mainstream theology. They'll start attributing it to Attar. And in the musical tradition, he's not the most used poet by any means in Persian classical music. But when they want something really, really intense, often they'll go to Attar. And it's worth also mentioning just the ways the Conference of the Birds has captured the imagination of Western audiences. Really remarkable that a 12th, 13th century work is being produced in so many different ways. So Peter Brooks did a theater version of it. There's a ballet version of it. There's a 3D Persian calligraphy version of Conference of the Birds. There are numerous translations and things like that. Often people will take out the praise of God and the praise of the Prophet Muhammad at the beginning, which is, as we said, is kind of a loss. There's so many translations of this. And I do think it is Attar's masterpiece and brings together everything he's saying. But the other ones are also amazing. And it would be lovely to bring forth more elements of those and to have those also contribute in these spheres. So that Conference of the Birds just speaks to everyone across context in this really beautiful way.
Yeah, I know. I saw there's even a jazz album. I think Dave Holland, the bassist, had an album, Conference of the Birds. And as you said, it's one of these works that kind of grabs people. It's one of the first works of Sufism I read in English and drove my interest in the field and in Sufi poetry. So that's great. All right. Well, Professor Zargar, Professor Boylston, thank you so much for your time discussing Attar with us. And to our listeners, I hope you tune in next time for our next episode of the Logic of the Birds podcast.